information on for quite some time, and we prepared the information that we've gotten back. And Susie Jordan and Ken Rocco have, over the last few weeks, become eminent experts in the field of reclassification. So LFO sent us their best resources here to work with us on this issue.
Oh my.
And I will now turn it over to Susie and Ken to outline the information that they have for us on the Marine Board.
Go ahead, Ken.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We've passed out two items to you today regarding the reclassification issue that's been before you on several agencies. The first, which is clipped together, is sort of a reverse chronology of what's happened since this committee sent a letter to the co-chairs requesting a review be done of all of the reclassification policies of the state. That letter was sent back in February. And then these are all the materials that we received from the Department of Administrative Services in response to that memorandum. Basically, the cover memo from Susie and myself to the co-chairs and Representative Morgan describe response the Department of Administrative Services has made. Basically, they're recommending that a interim study of the processes that are currently in place be conducted. They want to look at evaluating the state's current system for assigning points to positions. It's called the Hay system. It's a point factor job evaluation system. They're suggesting that a study work group be established comprised of individuals from DAS, state agencies, and legislative staff. And they are also suggesting that a comprehensive evaluation of all agency head positions in state government be conducted, primarily since there has not been such a review for about 10 years, I understand.
So these are big picture looks at the whole process across all the departments of the state government.
That's correct, Madam Chair, from what we're understanding at this point. Some of the attachments describe these things. The first attachment is basically the re-review of the position allocations that were included in the Division of State Lands and the Marine Board budgets, and they're on several pages on that first handout. And today you're going to be talking about pages 3 and 4 of that first one. And then on Wednesday, we'll get into the first two pages with the Department, with the Division of State Lands budget. The second attachment is a memorandum from Dan Kennedy to Mike Greenfield discussing, basically discussing these items of review that I just described to you. The third handout, which is a sheet like this, describes basically the current system now, as the position allocation system looks now, and what the proposal would be. And I think if you look at that, you can see where the changes would be, primarily in that there would not be an allowance for agencies to develop work-out-of-class systems before the legislature gets a chance to review them. And I think those were some of the issues that the committee noted in the current system, was that some of these reclasses had occurred for nearly 2 years before there was a legislative review of them.
Mr. Rocco, where is this proposal in terms of reality right now?
Madam Chair, I believe this is the proposal that the department is considering to review for implementation during the interim. This would be part of that interim study. And they're not prepared to implement this at this point, from what we understand. But it would be the subject of that interim review that would be conducted. The next handout shows, it looks like this, and it shows you what the, based on that Hoyt Hay point factor evaluation, what the scores of positions for Natural Resource Agency heads are. shows you other details about the salary ranges and when, and what salary ranges those positions are at. And the last handout is a memorandum, again, from Dan Kennedy and Mike Greenfield, talking about reclass issues. And this was the first.
Can I back up just a minute to this spreadsheet?
Yes.
What can you explain what the eval sal range and the paid sal range, what those two things mean?
Madam Chair, it would be my understanding that the evaluated salary range would be what the Hay Point factor system would determine the rate of pay to be, or the salary range to be. And the paid range is what the Department of Administrative Services has approved for that position.
And do the numbers actually relate to anything like 39/40? What does that mean in terms of salary?
Madam Chair, that refers to a specific salary range that has a series of pay steps. So it would extend from a entry level step up to the top step of that particular pay range.
And there are actually, Madam Chair, two ranges there. 39 is one, and 40 is a range. They're two different ranges. So
why do they have two ranges listed here then?
I don't have the answer to that. It's just that I believe that the Hay Point factoring system covers two ranges. There's a beginning and an end, and it covers the two ranges. That's why they list them. Is that what you think, too?
I believe that's the case. In terms they call, sometimes they refer to these as extended ranges, so they have extra steps in them to make it equivalent to the higher range.
And then the REV date, is that's a review date?
Yes.
So a whole bunch of these haven't been reviewed for 10 years?
That is our understanding, yes. And as you can see, the two in question here were reviewed in March of this year.
Madam Chair.
Representative Nola.
Mr. Rocco, is 40 the top range state system?
Madam Chair, Representative Nolan, I believe there are higher ranges for university presidents and other things like that. I'm not exactly sure what the top range is, but...
But for practical purposes, 40 is the top range?
For most large agency heads, that is the top range, except for the Department of Human Services, perhaps the Department of Corrections.
Please proceed.
And then finally would be this last memorandum, which was the first response that the Legislative Fiscal Office received back in February after the initial question was asked.
Well, it's curious then. Oh, I guess the Marine Board has just been reviewed, because there are on this list reviews that occur very regularly all through the decade.
That's this second handout in the packet is the review that they just did.
Okay.
At the subcommittee's request.
So this is all the existing documentation?
Yes, Madam Chair. This is what we have currently in hand from Department of Administration. And you also asked to provide the committee with options that exist based on this kind of information. And the second memo that Susie and I prepared for you describes those options. Basically, under state law, agencies can reclass positions without legislative review. They can do it through something called permanent financing. And this is a situation where they can eliminate positions, and they use those position savings to finance the positions reclass. And the permanent financing means that the full cost of implementing the reclass does not add anything to the agency's budget, basically, because they're using up other position dollars that they have. If they can't do it through permanent financing, they need to get legislative approval at some point. Under the current system that one schematic showed. Based on our review of this, there's basically three options that the legislative committee has, and they're listed on the bottom of this front page of the memo. But when the agency brings a reclassification package forward, the package can be approved, which means that you approve the funding of it and you approve the new position allocation that's requested in the reclassification. The committee also has the ability to approve or accept the reclass in terms of how the position is allocated, but you can deny the funding and you can tell the agency that they need to fund it themselves internally somehow. If this is the course that's taken, then the agency can use any kind of extra limitation within their budget or revenue and fund the reclass by cutting back on travel or S&S or whatever they need to do. And then in the next budget cycle, when the budget is developed for the next biennium, the reclass automatically is accommodated in the personnel information control system, and the costs of it are included at that new level that you have approved.
So it would be rolled into the next biennium's
That's
budget.
Correct. So by this course would give you savings, budgetary savings for one 2-year period. That's all you would get.
Representative Hansen.
Kind of a technical question. If you were financing your reclass through savings in materials and services, and then the next biennium, the current service level would pick up the cost of the reclass, would also the reduced services and materials, would those carry through at the lower rate, or would they revert to the higher rate?
I think it would depend on how the budget was constructed, Representative Hansen, because if the actual expenditures by category were accurately reflected, they would not be included in that category any longer, because they would have to have moved them to personal services costs. So I think they would not show up in that case.
Well, they would roll up by the amount that everything rolls up by from the lower level, though.
But Madam Chair, I believe what would happen is they would shift those costs from an S&S category. They would shift them into a personal services category as a salary and wage, and they would roll up in that salary and wage total, not as an S&S line item.
Okay, but what was left in the S&S budget would roll up.
Correct, that's correct.
And then go ahead. More questions? Representative Nolan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. But at least in recent history and probably in the foreseeable future, current service level inflation in compensation area exceeds the rate of inflation in supplies and services because of health care, because of step increases, because of pension costs. It's a lot more expensive to go current service level on $1,000 worth of compensation costs as $1,000 worth of services and supplies.
Representative Krieger.
Chair Morgan, your second bullet down there talks about will not produce any future budgetary increases. How can that happen? Maybe I'm missing something. In other words, if you increase something now, how would it not create a higher budgetary thing the next time through on 100 employees, roll-up costs and that? Am I misunderstanding something?
Madam Chair, Representative Krieger, that is the definition of what permanent financing means. It means that you make sufficient reductions in your current existing budget on the personnel side, so that your reclass does not generate any additional costs in the future biennium. It's based on what you're taking from and what you're gaining. So there will be costs because all positions go up. But
that's what I'm saying.
You have to eliminate a position to create a new position.
Or parts of a position, right, to create a new position. Or establish or reclass a position.
So would it be fair to restate it by saying that you would have the same net bottom line dollar amount in your personnel budget, but you'd be just allocating it differently?
Yes.
Representative Hayden.
Well, I had the same question Representative Krieger had, which has been answered, but I want to carry it a step farther. I can understand how the leadership of an agency would eliminate some positions and reclassify frontline workers upward. But I can't see how the administration of an agency could eliminate foot soldiers and reclassify their own positions upward. I don't think that that would be a viable solution. And that's one of the bullets on the back page here that says, find permanent financing, which means using salary savings from either eliminating an existing position or reclassifying other positions downward to generate enough personal services dollars to finance the upwardly reclassed positions for 24 months. If permanent financing cannot be accomplished, the agency is not able to reclassify the position. I think aren't what we're discussing in this small agency is largely agency heads being reclassified?
That's a good point. Susie, for the benefit of Representative Lowe and just to refresh all our memories, can you kind of give us the box that we're talking about here with personnel?
For the Marine Board?
Yes.
In particular? Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee. The Oregon State Marine Board brought a proposal to the table to reclassify the director and the deputy director and a couple of other lower level positions. The issue on the table is the director and the deputy director position. The deputy director position was reviewed and determined to have duties and responsibilities that exceeded that of the director. The recommendation was to reclassify that position upward by the Department of Administrative Services. As a result of that, the director's position was also requested to be classified upward. The committee is questioning a couple of things. One, whether a deputy director position is needed, and two, how an agency can assign duties and responsibilities to a deputy that exceed the director's responsibilities. And that's why we asked the Department of Administrative Services to take a look at those two positions.
Can you give us a little bit of history on how there came to be a deputy director?
Madam Chair, I can't tell you how there came to be a deputy director. Senator Dukes had advised the committee that about 8 years ago there was a deputy director position that was eliminated, and that elimination was agreed to by 10 years ago.
1991, in the wake of ballot measure 5.
As a result of reductions in revenues. That agency agreed that they didn't need a deputy director at that time, that they could restructure their works to do without that. And over time, it appears that duties and responsibilities have been accumulating to this position, which is now being discussed. Thank you.
Okay. So here we are with the DAS report on whether or not to reclassify, and the LFO folks presenting us with the options that we have to deal with the issue.
Chair, the third option then would be to basically reject the entire package and the ability of the agency to reclass. And to do that, the legislature would need to provide some direction in the budget report, which would direct the agency to either find permanent financing, to change work assignments among staff so that there's no need for a reclassification, to restructure the agency in some way to improve efficiencies and operational functioning so that a reclass wouldn't be necessary, or direct them that they could re-look at the organizational structure and return to some other legislative review body at some point, which would either be the emergency board during the interim or come back to the next assembly with a revised proposal for reclassification. Based on our review at the bottom of the first memo we gave you, our recommendation is to allow this review process to take place, since the committee has noted that there are some serious issues in this reclassification process that's currently in place. We would recommend that management positions, agency director reclassifications not be approved at this point until the review that the Department of Administrative Services has proposed is completed and a report made to the legislative review agency. Depending on the timing of that review, when it's done, if it's the emergency board has the authority to approve reclassification. So when that review is completed, and if it meets the merits of what the emergency board would like to see, the board could then go ahead with approval of reclassifications. If it isn't done in time for emergency board action, it would need to be brought back to the next assembly.
Representative Hayden.
A question of the administrator. In the event that the Ways and Means Committee would accept your recommendation and opt to proceed with a further study before allowing the reclassification, as I remember, Madam Chair, the request here was really not for reclassification, but a request to ratify reclassification that had already occurred. Would the salaries then be reduced to their previous level, or would the funds be recaptured, or what would happen?
Madam Chair and Representative Hayden, in the Marine Board's case, my recommendation is to remove the funding for the work out of class and direct the agency to review its organizational structure based on the information that was provided by the Department of Administrative Services review. In that case, you've removed the funding with a clear message to stop the work out of class. The only way to stop work out of class for the deputy director in this case would be to remove duties. So you'd have to further instruct the director then to remove those duties. Otherwise, they would still, under the executive rules, have to pay the work out of class for additional duties. So that would, the committee would have to make, give that instruction then. And I believe that would be the case. In a director's case, the director is doing the job no matter what they're getting paid. They're doing the job at the level that they're supposed to do it. So there are no duties to remove. But in the case of deputy directors or management positions under the director, duties can be removed to bring it in line with the classification that they were getting paid.
Further questions or comments?
Can you help me put a face on this? Can you let me understand what some of the extra duties are that the director needs the assistance with or would now have to absorb if we eliminated that position or put a cap on the activities of the deputy director?
Madam Chair,
help me understand.
I don't have the details for that classification. Those were provided to us by the Department of Administrative Services. Some of that has to do with the size of the organization or the number of people that are being supervised. It has to do with the dollar amount that they have responsibility for approving in a fiscal sense. It has to do with the amount of policy decisions that they make without review. So there are varying levels of that, and the magnitude of that is dependent on the kind of agency, the operations of the agency itself. So there would be some adjustment being made in those areas. So it's possible that the director might have to approve more work products than the director has been in the past, or there would be some kind of a post review of a decision that was made. So that's about.
Well, and it's our hope that when they do the study on the reclassification, that information is what will be brought forward to whoever will be making the decision on whether to allow it or not. Representative Nolan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We forget that when you make budget cuts, something doesn't get done. And what we understood when we first heard this is that the legislature, at the governor's recommendation 10 years ago, said stop doing certain things. We understand you cut something out, that means you don't do as much as you used to do. And over the last decade, the agency has decided to add back many of those things that it had been directed not to do in trying to serve the public. I don't doubt that. The harsh reality is that when there's less money, you don't do as much. And the issue that came to a head here was that had gone on for a number of years, just below the radar screen, and without coming back to the legislature and saying, have you changed your mind? Are you willing to let us do the things you once told us to stop doing?
Representative Hansen.
Well, I think there may be another issue here, too, that may have occurred. When you flatten management systems, one of the things that may not be taken into account is as you remove a step, you're actually upgrading the levels and the responsibilities of the people below and who are subject to reclass. And it's easy to forget that piece in terms of saying, yeah, we've saved money with this position, but incrementally we may be needing to increase the responsibilities of the people below. And if that's reflected in a reclass, then there's some cost. As Nolan was explaining, we're asking them not to do certain things. But in effect, probably those things that we're asking not to be done still are necessary to get done. It's just that other people are doing them. And there's kind of some gradual reclass creep. In this case, instead of addressing all the reclasses of the people at the third tier, they've been consolidated back into a second tier. I don't think that clarified anything, but I feel better.
May I ask a question of the committee then, or somebody? Can I ask a question of the ether? I would assume, and maybe I'm assuming incorrectly, that the reason why these tasks have crept back into the agency is probably because the public is needing them or demanding them for some reason. And these duties, maybe that's not an accurate assumption. Maybe it's those things that have crept back in and now are staring us in the face with dollar signs attached to them are simply style points of the way the agency would prefer to manage itself. So are we shorting the public by saying, can't do this anymore? Are we creating a problem for any of our constituencies by saying this? Or will things, at least from the public's perception, continue on at the same service level? Can you give me some ideas about that?
I'll give you my personal perspective on this from going over the documentation. I don't think we have the information to make that judgment. I think that will be the function of asking the department to take a look at its organizational structure and the duties of the people within the structure to make sure that there's no duplication and that there's a sensible assignment of the duties to the positions. But we flat don't have that information at this point in time. And we have, some justifications for reclassing that have come to us from DAS, but quite frankly, they raise more questions than they answer. And the substantive information about how the agency functions internally isn't part of the discussion yet. Representative Hayden.
Madam Chair, if it would be of use to Representative Lowe, prior to your joining the committee, when we first heard this budget, we were provided with a 10-year spreadsheet, actually I think more than a 10-year spreadsheet, of revenues available to this agency. And you have that?
I'm sorry.
And the funds available have doubled or tripled in the last 15 years, so I believe that I believe that the agency has been able to provide valuable services to the public with those 200 or 300% increases in revenue. So I think the public has gotten their money's worth over the years.
You'll make senator.
Yeah. Some senators.
Control for a senator. What I'd like to do is just kind of get everyone's questions answered as much as we can, and then we'll go into work session. So we're out trolling for senators right now.
Does that mean we're standing at ease?
No, Madam Chair, I would like to call the committee's attention to the second part of this, the bigger packet that has the DAS's review on the State Marine Board. That was page 3. There's a couple of things here that justify your action on this, taking another look at the organizational structure. When the Department of Administrative Services reviewed the agency director and deputy director, they came up with a point factor and a recommendation, but they questioned the need to have a full-time deputy director in addition to the director. And an executive assistant to the director in an organization that has 44 employees. And their recommendation is to review the organizational structure that would eliminate some of the overlap of duties and responsibilities between those three positions, and have made a suggestion on how their organization could be more efficient. And I think that until you have some information on that organizational structure, that it would be prudent to defer action on a reclassification until you've seen some of that detail. So, it isn't necessarily that you're going to be taking duties and responsibilities away from the agency. It is taking another look at how those duties and responsibilities are being carried out and whether there is a more effective and efficient way to do that without reclassifying all the positions. Also, part of my recommendation, as Ken Rocco mentioned, was that the director's position not be reclassified until after all of the director positions have been reviewed and that can be put in context.
I'm trying to find a way to relate this to my litmus test, Madam Chair. Can you tell me what percent of the Oregon State Marine Board's total budget is allocated to administration?
Not very easily, Representative Lowe, because they also lump education in their administration program. Let me just
have Senator Dukes has gone home sick, so we have Senator Hannan again graciously joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
Jeez, I thought I'd done something.
You did.
You did, but we'll take that up later.
Yeah, not for a few weeks.
Thank you.
Is that because we just haven't seen?
Are there any more questions that need to be answered before we go into work session? Senator Lowe, do you feel that you got an answer to what you were asking?
Senator
Lowe feels really good about this.
Sorry.
Thank you for the promotion.
You don't get more pay.
I know the pay still stinks here. If we could reclassify ourselves as, you know, from representatives to senators or maybe to...
This is not Nebraska, where everybody's a senator, no House members.
Representative Lowe, the administration education budget is about 18% of the total budget.
18%.
Right, but that does
and
include a...
That does include a component for education services,
yes,
that they
yeah
provide.
Which is about yes half a percent.
Which is a half a percent?
I'm guessing. I don't have that here.
I think I have to go back and try and separate that out. But it's one position in administration.
If there are no more questions, I will close the public hearing and open the work session so that we can discuss the LFO recommendation. And the public hearing is closed. The work session is open. Susie, could you present us with Legislative Fiscal Office's recommendation?
I can. Madam Chair, members of the committee, the memo in front of you is a recommendation to deny the reclassification of the director and the deputy directions and remove funding for the work out of class of the positions, with a budget note that directs the agency to review its organizational structure and address the overlap of the duties and responsibilities between the director, the deputy, and the executive assistant as recommended by the Department of Administrative Services. And that those classifications should they should recommend to the emergency board a structure that improves the operational functions and increases efficiency with appropriate position classifications. The classifications shall be reviewed and approved by the Department of Administrative Services, and that position analysis and recommendations shall be presented to the emergency board for approval and authorization for expenditure limitation at that time, and that the consideration for any change in the director's position be included in the Department of Administrative Services review of all director positions and presented when that review is complete. If you agree with this recommendation, then you're removing from the administration portion of the budget $28,415, which is the work out of class pay that they, the agency is currently budgeting for the increase in reclassification. And I should explain that your prior action was to approve those reclassifications without funding. This $28,000 was to come out of their supplies and services. And since I'm recommending removing the work out of class pay, that would be the amount that they would have paid out of their services and supplies for reclassifying the positions.
So that will, that will put the money back in to services and supplies.
It removes it.
Completely.
My action removes it, yes.
Completely.
My recommendation removes it, yes. But as a point of practicality, you would also need to direct the agency to remove duties and responsibilities from the deputy to avoid payment of work out of class. I didn't include that in my recommendation, but you would
need
to do that.
Add that in.
Yes, otherwise that position would be paid work out of class.
Representative Hanson.
Yes. Would this go into effect July 1?
Chair Morgan, Representative Hanson, for the budget, it would go into effect July 1. For practical purposes, with the direction of the legislature, it should go into effect immediately. But I can't speak for how the Department of Administrative Services would have implement that.
The second question of the $28,000, would that, okay, if we're asking them to go back to the emergency board after there's, would there be a reservation for the emergency board to make adjustments at that point?
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, they wouldn't need a reservation. This is other funds, and that money would just go revert to their ending balance, and would be available at that time.
Representative Hansen, I mean, Representative Haley.
Well, I'll repeat my earlier question, and it follows up on Representative Haley's question, Hansen's question. But it would not be retroactive. So it would be either today or July 1, but not retroactive.
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Nolan.
Madam Chair, if committee staff could refresh my memory, weren't there other reclassifications in this proposed budget besides the director and deputy director? And could you tell me, refresh my memory of what we recommended on those?
Representative Morgan, or Chair Morgan, Representative Nolan, there were two other reclasses in this budget. One was an information systems position that was being reclassified from one level to another, and the other was a program manager.
And did the committee take action on those previously?
Yes, Representative Morgan, committee members, yes, they agreed to those.
Okay. Refresh my memory on the piece that we need to add to your recommendation.
That would be to remove, to direct the agency to remove duties to and responsibilities from the deputy director to bring them in line with this current classification.
Madam Chair, are you ready for a motion?
I am ready for a motion.
Madam Chair, I'd move the LFO recommendation on the reclass and the adoption of the budget note.
And Senator, would you amend your motion to add language that would remove the duties and responsibilities from the deputy director to bring it in line with this recommendation?
Correct.
We have a motion on the floor to accept the LFO recommendation as amended. Is there discussion on the motion? Is there objection to the motion? Hearing none, the motion is passed.
Chair Morgan, then with that adoption of those recommendations, you would approve the budget in the amount of $21,127,690.38 FTE. With amendments to House Bill 5030, amending Section 1, Other Funds, Line 10, Administration Education, deleting $3,756,018 and inserting $3,727,603. Line 11, Marine Law Enforcement, insert $7,987,187. Line 14, Facilities, Construction and Maintenance and Land Acquisition, insert $5,632,395. And in Section 2, Line 19, Administration of Education would be $113,405. Line 20, Marine Law Enforcement, there's no change. Line 23 is deleting $1,481,447 and inserting $1,481,415.
The chair would accept a motion to amend the LFO recommended appropriation in the bill.
So moved.
Is there discussion on the motion, Representative Hayden?
Technical question, Madam Chair. In one place, the administrator said there was no change, and on line 11 and 14, there are also no changes. And I'm just wondering if there is some protocol. I'm wondering why we had to include those lines at all.
I'm sorry. Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, you didn't. Those were the dollars that you had previously approved. The only change is really in line 10.
All right.
Further discussion on the motion? Can we do this by unanimous consent?
Yes.
Is there, Representative Lowe,
would you please repeat the change to line 10?
Line 10 is removing the $3,756,018 that you had previously approved and inserting $3,727,603. That's the reduction of the workout class.
That would be the, okay.
Okay. Further discussions? Are there any objections? Seeing no objections, the motion is passed.
Madam Chair, while the co-chair is here, I'd just like to inquire if there's maybe some way we can get an appropriation for a minimum wage for members of the legislative body.
Minimum wage?
Yeah.
Well, it's double time for co-chairman, so I'd be happy to accommodate you anyway.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
Minimum wage for 16-hour days sounds pretty good.
The chair would now accept a motion to pass House Bill 5030 to full ways, 5030 as amended to full ways and means.
So moved.
Thank you. We have a motion on the table. Is there any objection? Can we do this one by unanimous consent? Hearing none, the motion is passed. On the floor, Representative Nolan, would you carry the bill?
Be happy to.
And in the Senate, Senator Farioli, I'm afraid you're the only one we have to put this on to.
Not a problem.
And Representative Hansen, would you carry it in full ways and means?
Certainly.
The next item on the budget is a public hearing and work session relating to House Bill 129 relating to unclaimed property. And Mr. Rocco is the legislative fiscal officer on this bill.
And relative, Madam Chairman, to Representative Crump's issue about minimum wage, we're on a minimal wage program now. So I think that going to minimum wage may not make much difference.
Well, Madam Chair, just to clarify my comments, I have said previously, and will again for the record, that if we have to do any additional budget cutting later on, I'm happy to start with my own salary, such as it is.
Well, yeah, big deals.
Mr. Rocco, please
give that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, House Bill 2129 is before you. I provided you with a copy of the bill. The staff measure summary from the House Committee on Rules, Redistricting, and Public Affairs, from which this bill has been sent to Ways and Means, and the fiscal impact. The reason the bill is here before you is the fiscal impact on the bill. Basically, this bill reduces the time period that intangible property, such as payroll checks and other kinds of unclaimed property, is held is from 5 years to 3 years, and it reduces the time that records relating to this unclaimed property must be kept. The fiscal impact identified some additional staffing needs that the agency said they needed to have because of the influx of claims that would come forward because of the reducing the time frames involved, and some costs related to educational material that must be mailed out to businesses under the requirements of the bill. We Legislative Fiscal has been working with the agency to adopt a revised budget package in their budget that would accommodate these activities and some other activities that the agency had anticipated in the budget with the package they had. And I think with a modification to that package, we will likely be able to handle the fiscal impact of this bill within the budget.
Madam Chair.
Senator.
Could I ask you a question?
Of course.
Mr. Rocco, this bill cutting down from 5 years to 3 years, is basically this to expedite so that a business person doesn't have to devote the additional time of record keeping, or is this intended to expedite the division of state lands to clear their records.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, Senator Hannon, I believe it's a combination of both, but it, from my understanding of testimony that was presented to the House Committee, Substantive Committee, that this would help businesses because they wouldn't be required to retain records for that long. I believe there's individuals here to testify.
Okay.
On that.
I'm sorry. Okay, thank you.
Are there any questions for Mr. Rocco on the presentation? We have Sean Miller here from the Oregon Grocery Industries Association and Jeanette Holman here from the department. And I will call Sean Miller forward to testify on the bill. Good afternoon, Sean.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Sean Miller, I represent the Oregon Grocery Industry Association. I'd like to just give the committee a brief history behind the bill, the policy that has been incorporated in the House Rules Committee in the A engrossed version that has been amended, and then also just address why it's down here in Ways and Means at the moment. First of all, history behind this bill, it went back to this interim committee. The House Interim Business Committee addressed this particular issue as it relates to businesses and how they handle unclaimed property. As you know, and I know that Jeanette can do a better job of the describing this division within the Division of State Lands, but there is an unclaimed property division. All businesses must turn in this unclaimed property under a certain dormancy period. Unclaimed property is checks, business-to-business transactions that's not collected. For instance, I write the chair a check. She does not cash that for a period of 5 years, which is a dormancy period under current law. Under that time period of the 5 years, I, as a business, has to do my what they call the due diligence, and that is to make sure to try to find that owner. And if I am unable to find that owner, I then turn over the money to the state. And at that point, it's their responsibility. If the chair then at a later date comes back to the state, Division of State Lands, and says, I had this check, the Division of State Lands will turn over that amount of money. And then I'm off the hook after that dormancy period as a business. I want to state the business community in general, the Oregon Grocery Association, does support turning unclaimed property to their owners. I know Representative Lowe did serve on that interim business committee that heard the bill. We've had several, and I would like to state that the law has been on the books for quite some time. However, there's a very low compliance rate with businesses, and quite honestly, the business doesn't even know it exists. Not that businesses are trying to get around this law. Most requirements like taxes and there's notices that are sent out on business registration, information that requirements that a business knows to comply with. The reason we brought this bill to the legislature is that the division has auditors, and what they've done in the experiences in our industry is you'll see testimony following mine from Roths. That goes back from the interim committee, and I can also give an example from Franz Bakery, where we looked at the policy when these audits took place, and the money that was either claimed as unclaimed property and what was actually considered unclaimed property were two different things. A fairly lengthy audit process that cost businesses a lot of money. A lot of it was the dormancy period. We feel that under 5 years dormancy period, that means you have to hold another 5 years, which is a 10-year record retention period. That is longer than the IRS requirements, as Senator Hannon mentioned. We wanted to look at the policy perspective and put it more in line on record retention, but also make sure that our folks are getting into compliance. The first thing on the bill is requiring, the first component of the bill is requiring businesses to get some form of information from the state, letting them know that they need to comply with the law. With a very low compliance rate, we were worried that many of our other businesses who might not be in compliance will have to go through these audit tactics, and and to get them back online, which included estimating, and I'll like to talk about that particular example and why we wanted to reduce the amount of time frame from 5 years to 3 years, 3 years being the dormancy period proposed in the bill, which would mean a six-year total record record retention time frame. The five-year period, if a business did not have records indicating from an audit that that they didn't have records of their unclaimed property, they would look at their check register, find a find out how much unclaimed property was in that time frame period, and then they would estimate out 10 years. And the problems in many cases, and I'll give an example, in the Franz Bakery case, they had about 3 years' worth of records and uncovered about $121,000 worth of unclaimed property. In that three-year period, if you estimate that back out 7 years, which was how they were looking at it, and I know the division is very flexible. They do work with the businesses on trying to work with them to find what is actually unclaimed. Estimating up 7 years is about $40,000 a year that they had said was unclaimed property under their records. It that equates to about $282,000 for that that 7 year period. If you take a 10 year total, and that's without penalties, and it was about $403,000, a little over that. Now, in that particular audit, which I will state that's a bad, that's a really tough example because that was our worst case scenario. The Ross example is a little bit lighter. They spent $50,000 in external help and audits, 1,500 hours of research of about $20-$30 an hour of paid staff to uncover these 30 years worth of bank statements and to validate the money that it was not unclaimed property. Because basically, under the audit, they were told these are all unclaimed. It's the business's responsibility to say that it's not. And so with all that, in the end, the state settled with Franz Bakery for $5,000, which was considered unclaimed property. Now, huge expense, very large price tag on the audit could have been very high for the business. We want to make sure that the policy of the unclaimed property is being upheld. And we want to make sure that that amount of money is it gets to the state on time and gets to the owner. There's no argument from our organization or any of the business community. However, we wanted to look at the policy of if 5 years is appropriate. Now, in the original bill, we said 1 year. Now, that was a little, probably a little too drastic going from 5 years to 1 year because many businesses want to turn at the end of the 1 year, close their books, you know, and not have to carry over a separate account of money. One of the advantages to this bill is the money goes to the common school fund under the money that we give in the interest, and correct me if I'm wrong, Janet, but the money that you place as unclaimed property goes into the common school fund, which then interest is accrued. A five-year period going to a three-year period of unclaimed property, you're getting to the state money faster. So into your account, we would argue, and I know it's difficult for people in the fiscal to estimate revenue impacts on the common school fund, but we would argue if businesses have legitimate unclaimed property, more businesses are complying with the law, they get it in at a faster rate, 3 years versus 5 years, well, that's 2 years worth of interest that the state is benefiting in the common school fund. So I want you to consider that as you consider the price tag on this, because I'll get to why there is a price tag put on this bill. And so again, I want to consider that difference, because obviously as businesses we don't want to hold the record retention to the 10-year period. It would be limited to six, which is closer to IRS standards. You get it in after three, and we believe there'll be a benefit obviously to the common school fund. Now the number one benefit to the state is more compliance, very, very low compliance. And we believe that we will have less trouble, our businesses, on audits getting hit on the back end if we can get the state to work on the front end getting businesses in compliance. And so that's why we proposed on an annual basis or a minimum annual basis just distributing information materials and a sheet to businesses that would need to, if they have unclaimed property, and that they fully understand the law. Now, I know the division does a job of doing seminars, and they advertise in the newspaper for businesses to do seminars. Unfortunately, the businesses that I talk to have never seen this information. I'm not saying that they should have or they shouldn't have. I just think that we need to do a better job from a policy perspective, trying to get businesses on the compliance on the front end rather than the audit on the back end. Now, we're not doing anything with auditing, we felt it was very important from the business community to get our folks in compliance. And so, yeah, we have some horror stories why we brought the bill to the legislature. It did pass out of the Interim Business Committee as a recommendation to the legislature. It passed unanimously out of the Rules Committee. Sent here, you have the Engross version, and the fiscal is about, I think it's a little over $100,000. A lot of that money is because of the mailings. And what we asked to do in Rules Committee, with Carl Wilson, was to coordinate with the Department of Revenue or the Department or the Secretary of State. You know, they already have these businesses, and they already send annually either tax statements or information on their business registry. We want them to coordinate with these agencies so we're not doing something separate. The business will get material, and they'll know and they'll understand that they need to comply with the law. Now, if they don't comply with the law in a few years, then at least we gave the honest effort as a state to try to get those folks, and then and we don't have an argument then when they do get audited later on and for not complying with the law. But we feel that because of a lot of the audits that have taken place, we really need to concentrate on the front end, and that explains the fiscal. And so if there's any other questions, Madam Chair, and I hope I answered your question, Senator Hannon, as well.
Yeah. Sean, in the fiscal analysis, the personal services are also related to the mailing, the $26,000, or is that just the $84,400 related to the mailing?
Madam Chair, I think you'll have to talk with the division on that, but I believe some of the personal services dealt also with when you go from a five-year to a three-year reporting period, there's a time frame of adjustment where the division might get more records than they've normally handled. And so I think to get into that cycle, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think some of that was to kind of get into that adjustment of going every 3 years and getting our businesses accustomed to that. Because I think initially there would be more records and more compliance, which we want, because that obviously that matches more people up with their money and benefits the Common School Fund while benefiting business. So
when the $84,400 was laid on the mailing requirement, was that done under the concept of full adding a sheet into someone else's mailing?
Madam Chair,
I'm having up and down nodding back there.
I believe so, and I think they're the ones who, you know, we probably have to ask them.
Madam Chair, for the record, Jeanette Holman, Assistant Director of Administration and Finance of the Division of State Lands.
And we have your testimony, which we could pass out now if you'd like.
In answer to your question about the mailing, we have already sat down with the Department of Revenue and talked to them about ways that we can share their mailing lists or inserts into their mailings. And that was the figure that they gave us for two mailings over the biennium, so that's only one mailing a year. We've also started exploring using the business portal and a number of other kind of innovative ideas for getting the information out.
And Madam Chair, the staff costs that you were referencing are, I think in the fiscal impact statement in the second paragraph under the comments section, it describes basically what Mr. Miller was also describing was an increase in activity for a short period because of the condensing of the correct.
Are there any questions or comments for Mr. Miller? Representative Lowe.
I just have one comment about does it make sense to me? It did when we talked about it in committee. But assuming I was there.
You were there.
I think I sort of remember this. But the one downside to it that I can see is that the statute of ultimate repose for litigation in a state is 10 years. And should there be underlying litigation regarding the unclaimed property,
prudent business person would hang on to the records for 10 years. So that was the only downside to it. We've lived with this disconnect between what the feds require tax-wise for tax records and what the state requires for a number of years. And I guess you don't have to destroy the records if you're worried about litigation coming up later.
Madam Chair, Representative Lowe, to address that, when a business does hold on to the records, it has traditionally been according to the IRS. And so a lot of our folks, when we started talking about this issue, and we had for one item of records something more than the IRS has required going out 10 years, all of a sudden they, a lot of them didn't have the records or realized, no, we didn't keep that, because we keep what's according to the IRS standards. So we wanted to try to match that, and I think you're right when it comes to, now for us, any litigation we do, if you're complying with the law and you hand it over, that money that is rightfully that person's would be claimed through the division. So, you know, I don't know of what kind of litigation that might be, but we
want. Well, most of your litigation would lie in contract anyway, or tort, and which has an even shorter statute of limitations, but
yeah.
For all intents and purposes, I just wanted to put on the record that our ultimate repose is 10 years.
Thank you. Representative Hayden, did you have a question?
Yes, I do. What under statute, how far back may Division of State Lands go in auditing for unclaimed property?
Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, I'm not sure there's not a limit per se, but we're only going to go back probably if they're only required to keep their records for a certain number of years. We wouldn't go beyond that record period.
Oh, Madam Chair, I think that should be stipulated. I'd be very uneasy. I'm very uneasy with the concept that the division can go in and audit a business and then assess a claim for estimated unclaimed property when they have no idea whether there really was any unclaimed property there, and then retain the money for state purposes. It doesn't seem equitable. If there's actually unclaimed property where they are really trying to find the owner, I think that's a useful service. If they are estimating unclaimed property with no intention of trying to find an owner, I don't see why they should be allowed to do that beyond a certain point in time in any case.
Mr. Miller.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, that was the very argument we made in the Rules Committee, is that, and if you look on the website, their goal is to reunite people with their money, something we support. However, the division was generating revenue, we felt, from it, because when you're estimating, you're not fulfilling the goal of reuniting people with their money. If you estimate, there's no owner. You have ownerless money. And now, there is an argument, though, that if someone was not in compliance, then obviously they weren't having that money sent in. And so there is an argument on their side. But the goal of reuniting people with their money, we felt that by limiting the time frame and also putting, there is an amnesty provision in the bill, and I will say that we'll give folks a few years to get into compliance without hardship and without penalties, and it's something the division agreed to. And so to answer your question, we wanted to get more folks in compliance with the law, and then we wanted to, and I will say that is right, section 9 on page 2 of the bill, let me see. Wait, let me see here. But yeah, we did take out the, yeah, on dealing with the actual estimating. We felt that when you get more folks in compliance, you reduce the record retention to where their normal record retention habits are to a business, then all of a sudden that would, in our opinion, eliminate the estimating because they have the records. And so it was something that we met with the Division of State Lands several times to try to work this out and get to come up to an agreement on, and that's where we have now.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hayden, in addition, we have had people come in when we've done an estimate, and usually what they come in with is a check from that period of time that has never been cashed, and we pay that out of the money we collected as part of the estimate. We'll have a claimant come in who has a check from a business that's never been cashed. And so we know that there are people out there who we have, where we've just done an estimate on a business because they had no records to turn over to us so that we'd have records of who paid, but the person still has the check. So they'll come in to us, and out of that money that we have collected from that company as an estimate, we pay the check amount to the person.
I would also remind the committee that the policy issues have been more than adequately worked over in the policy committee, and that we are here primarily to deal with the fiscal impacts, and if we think that this is possible to do, we need to deal with how we're going to weave this into the agency's budget. We haven't even got there yet, and we still have another bill to do, and we have about 40 minutes left.
Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair. Sean, good bill. The policy, I think, is correct. What you're trying to accomplish, I'm concerned about the fiscal impact just because of we are in a, what's been characterized as a very tight budget environment. Could you go over with me again how the state has benefited in interest income for the under the current policy, which allows 5 years for something to be held in the common school fund, and help me make sense of how in a really tight budget environment I can vote for $110,000 fiscal impact on something like this.
Madam Chair, Representative Krupp, first I'll give it from the business perspective side, and then from, I won't speak on their behalf, but from what I believe will help on the state side. From the business perspective side on the audits, because there's such low compliance on complying with this unclaimed property, getting more folks in compliance. So when you go and audit, it'll be less auditing. Now, when you go and audit someone who is in non-compliance, it takes a lot of time. I'll state just the one example from Roth's and the example from Franz Bakery. It took 1,500 hours from a business perspective. It took a lot of time that the agency spent to accumulate $5,000. Now, I can probably, you know, the staff time and the time from the agency's perspective that it took to go through all those records, not to mention the business end and the expense to deal on their side, to get $5,000. We think the benefit of this particular bill, not only in the record retention, reducing from 5 to 3, but getting more folks into compliance, are the two answers to your question. 5 years to 3 years, the benefit to the state is obviously more money in the common school fund. If we're getting more people, more businesses in compliance with the law, they're getting their money in earlier. And that's 2 years worth of interest that is benefiting the common school fund. And so I believe just the interest alone benefit outweighs the expense on this price tag. From the business, we, you know, quite honestly, Madam Chair, you know, we weren't expecting the fiscal on this, and we understand that, you know, we were trying to avoid the fiscal and trying to avoid coming down here.
Well, Representative Krupp, does that answer your question?
Yes, Madam Chair, it does. Thank you.
Okay. I think what we do now is move to Jeanette and let her present the Division of State Lands position on the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The Division of State Lands supports the engrossed version of House Bill 2129 for a number of reasons. First, we believe it's consistent with our goals of the unclaimed property program.
to provide better service to the people of Oregon in returning unclaimed property to them, to the true owners, and to maximize the benefit to the Common School Fund that's derived from those funds while they're deposited in the Common School Fund. They are deposited in the Common School Fund in perpetuity until someone claims them. But in the meantime, the Common School Fund earns the interest off of those funds. Second, we believe that the statutory requirements to work with the Department of Revenue and other agencies provide an impetus to the department to develop a more effective outreach and education program, thus increasing the compliance with the law. And we agree with Mr. Miller that compliance has been very low. This law was adopted in 1957, and it is still remarkably low. We received a shot in the arm when we did get our auditors in 1995, but it's still very low. Finally, we believe it's consistent with a reorganization of our unclaimed property program that we're currently undergoing. We have looked at the entire program. We believe there are efficiencies to be made in that program to process claims faster to the holder or to the people who have the money coming to them, to take and manage the assets that come into that division in a more professional, better way. And so for those reasons, we think this bill promotes that vision of better management, more like a bank, because we feel like it should be managed like a bank. It is other people's money. Finally, there are costs associated with it, but we have been working with Ken to come up with a way to cover those costs as part of our budget package. And we had set aside, when we discussed our budget in February, the unclaimed property section program option package. And we have looked at it again with Ken and believe that we can reduce the $110,000 fiscal impact on this by about $10,000, $11,000 by combining those two options, the option package and this together. And we hope that you'll approve it.
Questions or comments for Ms. Holman? I will close the public hearing portion and open a work session, and the chair will accept a motion to move House Bill 2129A to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. So moved. We have a motion on the table to move the bill to full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? Representative Nolan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's my understanding that moving the bill does not appropriate the additional funds. Do we need to do that again separately?
Madam Chair, Representative Nolan, in this case, since these are other funds, all the agency needs is the expenditure limitation to spend the funds, and those will be accommodated in the budget when the committee reviews Package 107 in the Division of State Lands budget on Wednesday, which, as Ms. Holman has alluded to, there is a proposal to change that package slightly in order to accommodate workload within the unclaimed property section existing and from this bill being passed. So there's a mechanism to take care of increasing the expenditure limitation of the agency to deal with this impact.
Thank you. Then a brief comment, Madam Chair. I appreciate the effort that the bill represents, but I have a hard time appropriating $100,000 for it. And if that's what we're doing, I'll have to oppose the bill.
Madam Chair.
Senator. Oh.
Yes.
Please.
In response to that, this is not an appropriation bill. It doesn't appropriate one penny. The budget bill will set the expenditure limitation. The budget bill is what authorizes the agency to spend the money. So at that time on Wednesday, you would certainly have every right to oppose or vote no on it. This is only the mechanism dealing with the statutory language that operates the activity, not appropriating or authorizing the expenditure of any funds.
Thank you. You also may want to consider, Representative Nolan, that moving the unclaimed property into the state school fund at an earlier date will give the opportunity for more interest to accrue in the fund on that money.
We don't have a revenue estimate of that.
Madam Chair, Representative Nolan, the fiscal impact on the second page discusses the potential revenue impact, and at this time it's just impossible to calculate how much additional interest earnings would be generated because there's not enough information about how quickly the additional unclaimed property would move into the common school fund. But by any general estimation, it would increase, it would get money into the common school fund faster than under current law since there's that 2-year window. So,
and given Senator Hannon's comment that this is really approving the authority, the timeline, rather than appropriating funds, I'll support the bill because I like the idea, but I'd like to revisit it when we actually look at the budget
on
Wednesday.
I would ask you to reserve judgment on the financial side of it until we review the budget on Wednesday.
Will do. Thanks.
Representative Hayden.
Madam Chair, in my opinion, there's another class of beneficiaries here that we haven't really discussed. Page 2 of the testimony says, received $20 million in unclaimed property from over 3,000 businesses. Reunited 22,000 Oregonians with $5 million of the money. So Common School Fund retained $15 million, with which they can well afford to spend $100,000 to educate the businesses as to their responsibility. Those educated businesses then will then be spared the very real costs of audits, very expensive audits. So I see this as a pro-business.
Excellent point. Or is there any other discussion on the motion?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I also would concur. I think this is a great bill and concept in terms of it's good for business efficiency. It's also, I think it's clear that it's very, very good for staff efficiency at DSL in terms of getting more people into compliance more quickly. I think that alone gives us good reason to do this, and plus the fact that we can benefit the Common School Fund more quickly. Again, I'm satisfied that spending the $100,000, and perhaps it may be even less than that, is the right type of investment to make in this regard.
Thank you. Further comments? Hearing none, are there any objections to the bill? Without objection, the bill is passed. We need carriers, I'm told, on the House floor. Representative Krieger, would you carry the bill?
Yep.
Senator Ferrioli, I have to stick it with you again.
I'll
and
carry it, Madam
Chair.
Madam Chair.
I'll do the honor.
Oh, that would be great. And in the main committee, Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, we will now open the public hearing on House Bill 2150. House Bill 2150 is relating to spill prevention, and we have Mr. Rocco as our legislative fiscal officer on this bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 2150 is, I've given you a copy of the bill, the fiscal impact statement, and the staff measure summary from the House Committee on Stream Restoration and Species Recovery. This bill was approved by unanimous vote in that committee and referred to Ways and Means. If you recall in the discussion on the Department of Environmental Quality budget, this is the fee that the agency was talking about for their marine oil spill activities. So the fiscal impact of this bill is assumed in the governor's recommended budget, and I believe the bill is here just to have the committee tie this fee increase into the, to see how the fee increase relates to the budget package that you've already discussed. Today, we're only in a public hearing today just so we can get on the record the various sides of this bill, and then at a later date, we would propose to have a work session to pass it out.
So we don't need the senator here any longer.
Okay, you're not going to have a work session.
No work session.
Does this include card lock stations?
That was from Mr. Douglas.
Thank you, Mr. Rocco. Have you completed your presentation?
Yes, I am done.
I will call Rob Douglas and Liz Wainwright forward to present industry's position on the bill.
Thank you, Chair Morgan, members of the committee. My name is Rob Douglas, here today representing the Columbia River Steamship Operators Association and the Maritime Fire and Safety Association. With me today, to my right, is Liz Wainwright, Executive Director of the Maritime Fire and Safety Association. To begin, Chair Morgan, I think it's interesting to point out that this is, in fact, a DEQ fee increase that is supported by industry. The fee in question can be found on page 7 of the bill, section 6, and in some cases these individual statutory fees nearly double. But I want to stress to the committee that this is supported by industry and is something that we've worked in conjunction with DEQ to bring this about. The original legislation that brought all this forth, oil spill prevention planning, was passed by the 1991 Legislative Assembly. We were fortunate to be able to work with the agency and the legislature in putting that regulatory scheme together. We feel it's worked very well. In fact, it's been a model for other regions in the country. It is a unique public-private partnership that we feel serves the need of the state. And Ms. Wainwright will describe MFSA and why we support the bill.
Madam Chair, thank you. For the record, my name is Liz Wainwright, and I am the Executive Director for the Maritime Fire and Safety Association. Very briefly, the Maritime Fire and Safety Association was created in 1981. It is a not-for-profit, industry-funded cooperative. Originally started to provide funds to land-based firefighters on both sides of the Columbia River to respond to marine fires. From that, we grew to take on the responsibility for the contingency plan for oil spill response for vessels calling the Columbia River. And we've been doing that since the legislation in 91. The funds for that program come from industry. And our membership is made up of the marine terminals, the Columbia River Steamship Operators, and then we have active participation from the fire agencies, as well as DEQ, Washington Department of Ecology, and the U.S. Coast Guard. They all sit on our committees and participate in our programs. As Rob indicated, we have worked with DEQ on this bill, not only the language changes that we're looking for, but on the funding. We recognize that this is a significant increase over what we had before, but we believe that it is the appropriate time and the money is well spent and will be very necessary for DEQ to participate in the drill and the training exercise programs that we have, and that is very much an important element of being able to respond in a timely fashion. So we ask that you support this. We believe this is a good example of public-private partnership.
Questions or comments? Well, you're really getting off easy here. Thank you very much for presenting this to us. We chair calls forward now Paul Sliman from the DEQ. Good Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Chair Morgan, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Paul Slyman. I'm the administrator of DEQ's environmental cleanup program. I had the pleasure of seeing you a few weeks ago. As Mr. Douglas and Ms. Wainwright discussed, this has been a public-private partnership for about a decade. I wanted to talk to you a little bit about House Bill 2150 and how it improves that public-private partnership. My written testimony goes into a little bit of detail. All I really wanted to focus on was how this bill benefits Oregon. It benefits Oregon in three areas. First, and I'll jump right to it, it does increase the fees on the maritime industry. Those are barges, tank vessels, cargo vessels, facilities and pipelines that operate in Oregon or in Oregon waters. The amount of revenue that's generated allows us to retain the skilled personnel for spill response, plan review, and participation in spills, drills, and exercises. The second two major provisions of the bill do what I would assert is leveling the playing field. The bill enhances our current efforts by requiring that all petroleum, not natural gas, but petroleum-carrying pipelines, such as the one that moves 1 million gallons from Portland to Eugene every day, operate under the same planning and response standards that are already required for those pipelines that are near the Columbia or Lower Willamette River. Presently, there are 550 miles of petroleum pipeline in the state of Oregon, less than 30 of which are subject to the plan requirements of DEQ. This bill will ensure that all the pipelines are subject to our plan requirements. In my meetings with the pipeline industry, they've said we largely do most of those things anyway. The second substantive part of the bill that I will mention is that it requires the DEQ to meet with inland facilities and examine their spill response capabilities and report back to the legislature in 2003 with opportunities that perhaps we could investigate for improving the spill response capabilities of inland facilities. The passage of House Bill 2150 will provide Oregon with a limited but highly effective system to prepare for and respond to spills. Thanks for the opportunity to testify. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Questions or comments from Mr. Slyman?
I have a
couple. Representative Lowe.
I think that spills and such come from other sources besides maritime activities, specifically trucks that have wrecks near sensitive stream beds and so on and so forth. Does this bill address any of that?
Chair Morgan, Representative Lowe, that's an excellent question, and many of the spills that we respond to do, quite frankly, come from non-maritime sources. This bill is not going to eliminate those. What this bill will do to help us better be prepared for those spills is provisions of the bill firmly establish the DEQ as the lead agency for response to spills. After the hazmat teams have left, after the fire crews have left, then you have state agencies that show up. And some local agencies. This bill makes it clear that the DEQ will be the lead, will represent those other agencies, so there's more effective communication and spill response that happens.
Thank you. Are there questions or comments? Thank you very much. Is there anyone else in the room that wishes to testify on the bill? I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2150. Mr. Rocco, do you have an updated schedule for the committee members?
Madam Chair, I had delivered to all members' offices today an updated schedule going out through the end of the week of May 4th, which is, again, subject to change at any time. But if that happens, we'll try to let you know. As much of advance as we have. Tomorrow, the committee will deal with the water resources budget to pass it out to the full committee, and another bill, House Bill 2862, which is relating to commercial fishing.
So, the attendance tomorrow would be a required commodity around here. And having no further business today before the committee, the meeting is adjourned.